I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 20th of May. An editorial in the New York Times on April 19 caught our attention, titled Voting Rights by the Number. The first paragraph goes like this. When the Supreme Court struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, its main argument was that the law was outdated. But we ask the question this hour if indeed that is the case. Our guest has done a great deal of research on this issue, and he wrote a very lengthy report. Do the facts of voting rights support Chief Justice Roberts' opinion in Shelby County? Just to refresh your memory on this, in June of 2013, a 5-4 majority of the U.S. Supreme Court brought to an abrupt and, our guest says, likely permanent end to the most important provision of the most successful civil rights law in U.S. history. It required covered jurisdictions, at first in the Deep South and later extended to Texas, Arizona, Alaska, and certain counties and townships in other states, to pre-clear any changes in their election laws with the Justice Department or the District of Columbia before putting them into effect. Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the 5-4 majority, invalidated the formula because he said, quote, today's statistics tell an entirely different story. Our guest this hour has examined those thousands of statistics and will tell us what his findings are. Our guest is Professor J. Morgan Couser, professor of history and social science at the California Institute of Technology. He examined more than 4,100 voting rights cases, Justice Department inquiries, settlements, and changes to laws in response to the threat of lawsuits around the country, where the final result favored minority voters. He has done a couple books, has written a couple books, and he is currently working on two books concerning judicial cases and state legislative actions on racial discrimination in 19th and early 20th century public schools. He has been testifying before congressional committees on this issue and has done just an exhaustive study. He also does studies for various states who are concerned, members of certain groups concerned about voting rights in various states, including a very interesting one in North Carolina. He has been an expert witness in 35 federal or state voting rights cases. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Couser, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I really appreciate all the work you have done on this. You have examined so many of these cases. Let's start with what you talked about as being the most important part of this civil rights legislation and perhaps something that is going to be a permanent end to this most important provision of the civil rights law.
Well, let me explain quickly. Most of your listeners may know, but some of them may not. From 1957 to 65, the voting section of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department brought some lawsuits under the federal laws that were passed at the time, but many of them were unsuccessful. They were unsuccessful for two reasons. One, federal judges in the South either delayed cases or made rulings that were later overturned, and in any case made it more difficult to win those cases. And the second thing is that a lot of local jurisdictions would change the law a little bit to keep, essentially to keep blacks disfranchised. And then you'd have to file another lawsuit about another law. So when they passed the 65 Civil Voting Rights Act, the provision that's in question in Shelby County, Section 5, required the lawsuits to be brought in the District of Columbia, or the pre-clearance to go into effect with the Justice Department. And pre-clearance meant that in all of the so-called covered jurisdictions, first almost all in the Deep South, later on in Texas, Arizona, Alaska, California, New York, that any change in a voting law could not go into effect until it was okayed either by the Justice Department or the D.C. District Court. So that meant that a lot of changes that would have taken place otherwise would not take place.
Mm-hmm.
And importantly, the burden of proof was on the local jurisdiction to prove that the law was not discriminatory, rather than on plaintiffs in a voting rights case, for example, proving that it was discriminatory. And so that was a very important part of Section 5 as well. There were a series of cases, which we'll discuss in this time, which first made it easier to bring such challenges and made sure that if the change were, for example, a change in the structure of a local election, a change to at-large elections, or a change from an election system to an appointive system, or something like that, that those were also covered, that they had to be pre-cleared. After that lawsuit in 1969, the number of objections made by the Justice Department to laws mushroomed, and the number of laws that local jurisdictions brought to be pre-cleared also greatly expanded. So it made the law much more effective, and it made it much more difficult for local jurisdictions to follow the same sort of changes and strategy with the same effect that they had done before Section 5. That's why Section 5 was so...
Oops, hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay. The phone just went out from... That's why it was so important. What do you make of... He said more than this, but Chief Justice Roberts said, well, that was then. Now we don't need this formula because indicating really that things are so much better now, and I quote him, today's statistics tell an entirely different story, that things are a lot better where they used to be pretty bad.
Well, that's why I looked at 4,173 voting rights events to see whether that was true and to see whether they were still concentrated in the covered jurisdictions or whether there were a lot more cases outside the covered jurisdictions. What was actually thrown out was Section 4, which set up the formulas for covering jurisdictions. And there are two formulas. One is based upon turnout in the 1964, 68, and 72 elections, and whether there was a literacy test. That mostly covers Deep South elections.
Mm-hmm.
The second provides that in any county or state with a so-called language minority greater than 5%, for example, 5% Latino or 5% Native American, that would be covered also. That brought in Texas and so on. So the first question that Chief Justice Roberts asked, essentially, and the most basic one, really, are most of the events in the covered jurisdictions, or are there a great many events outside the covered jurisdictions? And nobody's been able to answer that question before because nobody's put together the data in exactly the same way that I put it together.
Hmm.
The answer to the question is that the formula for the covered jurisdictions is really very good. 93.9% of all the 4,173 events took place in the covered jurisdictions. If you were a stock picker and could pick correctly 94% of the time, you would be a very rich woman.
Right. I'm sure that's true. Well, my question is, how can the Supreme Court make such a decision without that information?
Well, there was a lot of information that was provided for the court. The Section 5 was renewed in 1970, 1975, 1982, and 2006. And in the run-up to the 2006 changes, There was a great deal of fear in the voting rights community that the Supreme Court would act to overturn it. So they went well out of their way to conduct hearings all over the country, and they compiled 15,000 pages of hearings and other information that they made available to the Congress. I studied all of the renewals, and this was by far the one with the most information about it. They listed just a huge number of these cases, and in fact, it's largely from that that I made all these brought all these cases into a database. Nobody had brought them, made them into a database. Nobody had quantified them by year, by county, by covered jurisdiction, etc. So the information was really available, not in exactly the same form, but in the basic form for the Chief Justice, but he just ignored it.
Hmm.
He says he ignored it. There were, as this was brought in federal district court in the District of Columbia, and then there was an appeal to the D.C. Appeals Court. And in both of those courts, the judges wrote quite extensive opinions that summarized the information, made what seems to me to be an overwhelming case. The Chief Justice basically ignored that, and he ignored what Congress had considered. He ignored the hearings, ignored all that information, and he just said, well, we know better. We know that a great many things take place outside the covered jurisdictions and not so many inside. He just never looked at the information, although the opinion is wholly dependent on the empirical questions of whether the events took place in the covered jurisdictions or in the non-covered jurisdictions and whether they have very substantially declined or not. He just didn't look at the data.
Mm-hmm. And what about the information outside the covered jurisdictions? Is that information not difficult to gather?
It is fairly easy to gather. You can certainly gather all of the court cases that are published, and those were gathered before the 2006 renewal. But let me give you an impression of what we're talking about. If your listeners want to find out maps of these, where the covered jurisdictions are and where the cases took place, if they just Google my name, they will fairly quickly come to a copy of the article. And I've got these very beautiful maps that my undergraduate research assistants drew that quite dramatically demonstrate how many of the jurisdictions with events are really in the covered jurisdictions. From 1957 through 1981, there were 807 events that took place. Of those, 98% were in covered jurisdictions. A similar period of time, from 1982 through 2006, when the Voting Rights Act was renewed again, there were nearly four times as many events, 3,121, of which 93% took place in covered jurisdictions. So as time went on, there were more events, and nearly as high proportion of them were in covered jurisdictions as in the early years of the Voting Rights Act.
Mm. And Professor Kauser, when you say events, let's talk about what some of those events are.
Well, some of them are Justice Department objections under Section 5. Some of them are what are called more information requests. If a jurisdiction submits a local law, a change in a local law for preclearance, the Justice Department can say, wait, we need more information about this, or maybe you want to rethink this. And the changes that resulted from that, if the jurisdiction withdrew its change or it changed its change to make it more favorable to minorities, those I included. The ones that didn't result in a change, I didn't include. Then there are, importantly, Section 2 cases. Now, Section 2 cases can be filed anywhere in the country, not just in covered jurisdictions. So you would expect if there were an equal number of an equal amount of discrimination in non-covered jurisdictions, you would expect to find about as many in non-covered jurisdictions as in covered jurisdictions. But you don't. In fact, 83% of all Section 2 cases have come from covered jurisdictions. And you have to take into account that some of the changes that took place that were discriminatory wouldn't even make it to a Section 2 case because they would have been blocked earlier by Section 5. So the concentration of all cases has got to be higher than the concentration of simply Section 2 cases. There's one more source that's very hard to get to that I took into account in the events, and that is settlements or consent decrees. They don't appear usually in published judicial opinions. So to get those, you have to essentially have friends who have brought such cases, and they got settlements. They didn't have to go to court. And since I've been working in the voting rights business for 35 years, I've got a lot of friends around the country who have brought voting rights cases, and they tell me about settlements and consent decrees in their cases. And so adding those is quite important.
Mm-hmm. And give us an understanding of the nature of the discriminatory acts.
Well, the ones that your listeners will probably be most familiar with are redistricting.
Mm-hmm.
What you'll find in a redistricting very often is they either pack minorities into a limited number of districts, or they crack minorities so that an area that is heavily minority is divided into two or more districts so that minorities can't really influence the elections. A lot of the cases are redistricting cases, but more of the cases, more than redistricting, are at-large election cases. I'll give you an example from a case that I worked in Florida. In Osceola County, which is close to Orlando, there was a marked, fairly sudden growth in the Latino population, mostly Puerto Rican, because there were housing developments, and housing developers appealed, advertised their houses in Puerto Rico. And so there was a sudden influx to this relatively small rural county of Puerto Ricans. So population that had been 2% Hispanic in about 1980 went up to 36% Hispanic by 2000. They had had at-large elections. They changed to district elections so that to vote for a county supervisor, you only vote for the county supervisor in your area. But then a guy who was a Puerto Rican ran in the first election under districts, and the whites said, oh my goodness, we're going to elect a Puerto Rican, we got to stop that. So they shifted back to at-large elections in the same election that they elected their first Hispanic candidate anywhere. This was not a covered jurisdiction, but the Justice Department sued under Section 2 and won, saying that's discriminatory. And I did a lot of examination and found that there was a discriminatory intent and a discriminatory effect of this sort of thing. So if you see that sort of change and it results in minorities having less opportunity to elect candidates of their choice than non-minorities, that's the sort of thing that's very often objected to or covered in a Section 2 case. There are other sorts of cases. Voter identification will be familiar to your listeners in Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
but there are voter identification laws in a whole series of states, and I'm sure we'll have time to talk about that.
And we're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. We're welcoming calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our guest, you heard him say, has spent 35 years examining voting rights in this country and has looked at 4,190-something voting rights cases, Justice Department inquiries, settlements, and changes to laws in response to the threat of lawsuits around the country where the final result favored minority voters. He found that from 57 to 2013, more than 90% of those events occurred in jurisdictions that were required to pre-clear their voting changes. As you know, the law that was passed by the Supreme Court, the decision in 2013, the main argument was that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act was outdated, and the Chief Justice saying that today's statistics are telling an entirely different story. Chief Justice Roberts wrote in the 5-4 majority, but our guest is saying that it's not an entirely different story, and he is explaining why through his exhaustive research on this very issue. Here is our number. Join us. 800-486-8655. He also did, I want to get to this sometime in the show, a report for the League of Women Voters v. North Carolina. When African Americans were Republicans in North Carolina, the target of suppressive laws was black Republicans. Now that they are Democrats, the target is black Democrats. The constant is race. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I guess this hour is Professor Morgan Kauser. He's a professor of history and social science at the California Institute of Technology. And if you want to see that map that he mentioned during the first half hour, you do spell his last name, K-O-U-S-S-E-R, and you'll be able to find all kinds of information about the vast amount of work he has done on this issue. Coming up, hour two of our program this Wednesday, we'll be talking about Detroit. It's gained a reputation as a failed city of abandoned buildings, poverty, bankruptcy, government dysfunction. Bankruptcy is now in its rearview mirror, and the Motor City is attracting investors and innovators and young artists. Next hour, a veteran journalist of the Detroit Free Press will join us to talk about how Detroit is ripe for a renaissance. We'll also speak with a pair of investors and find out about the reasons that they have grown to love Detroit and they want to restore Detroit. So that's coming up hour two of our show. Voting rights this hour. Feel free to join our conversation. We'd love to hear from you at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Let's look at what many people are seeing as voter discrimination in 2015, that we're not looking at poll taxes anymore or literacy tests. You mentioned voter IDs, polling places that are closing in minority neighborhoods, the elimination of early voting days, and more. Where do all of those, which many are saying are discriminatory, have any kind of legal recourse with a Supreme Court decision?
Yes. I mean, there are Section 2 cases and constitutional challenges that are being brought. And the one that is coming up this summer, it may be the first one to get to the Supreme Court, not sure, is from North Carolina. Maybe the Texas voter ID case, which has already been decided by a district court, will get there first. I also testified in an earlier version of that, at least. So we're seeing a lot of challenges to those sorts of laws.
And there has been bipartisan legislation, has there not? Can you describe it that would fix what you've just outlined?
Well, the Voting Rights Act Amendment Act has been proposed. To characterize it as bipartisan is probably not correct. Mr. Sensenbrenner, Congressman Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, is the most prominent Republican who has been for it. Mr. Sensenbrenner has been wonderful on the Voting Rights Act. He was in Congress in 1981 in the House when the Voting Rights Act was renewed at that point. He went to the hearings. He was convinced. He listened to the evidence. And he's been the most prominent Republican who's been in favor of keeping a strong Voting Rights Act. I wish other Republicans were as forthright and as strong as he is. But right now, the chairman of the Judiciary Committees in both the House and the Senate are against even holding any hearings on a proposed renewal of the Voting Rights Act with slightly different provisions. So it's very difficult to see how it could get promoted in Congress.
I was interested in this report that you did for the League of Women Voters in North Carolina. When African Americans were Republicans in North Carolina, the target of suppressive laws, black Republicans. Now that they are Democrats, the target is black Democrats. The constant is race. Would you care to amplify?
Yes. If I may, let me put on my historian's hat for just a minute.
Okay.
There were very interesting parallels to the current events that took place in the late 19th century. In the late 19th century, African Americans were Republicans. They were in the party of Lincoln, the party of abolition, the party of Reconstruction. They were against the Democrats, who were against them. So in North Carolina, Republicans continued to be very powerful even after the so-called end of Reconstruction in 1877. Democrats generally won, but there were still a lot of Republican votes. Democrats never got more than 54% in the gubernatorial elections from 1876 through 1892. In 1896, the Republicans, in fusion with the populists, actually took over the legislature and won the governorship. And they passed the most liberal election law in the South in the post-Reconstruction era. It made it a lot easier to vote. It made it a lot harder for election officials to cheat. And this made it possible for a lot of African Americans and white Republicans and populists to get elected. The Democrats didn't like this at all, so they had a very violent campaign in 1898 called a white supremacy campaign. They stuffed the ballot box in lots of places. And then in 1900, they passed a constitutional amendment with a poll tax and a literacy test in it. And they did so by fraud, absolutely, completely by fraud. If you look at the statistical estimates of voting by race in that election, 75% of black adult males voted to disfranchise themselves. Not a credible result.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a long period in North Carolina when essentially almost no African Americans could vote. This was broken more than anything else by the Voting Rights Act in 1965. The Democrats, many of them were still anti-black, and they passed redistrictings that were discriminatory. They passed election laws that were discriminatory and all of that sort of stuff. Then there was a shift to the Republican Party during the Reagan years, and Democrats became more favorable to African Americans, and African Americans got a lot more power within the Democratic Party. Starting in 1999 and continuing through 2009, there were a whole series of election laws that were passed by the Democratic majority legislature that made it a lot easier to vote. There was an extension of what was called early voting. It was no excuse required absentee voting, but you could do it by voting at a polling place in the first, in 17 days before the election and the period up to 3 days before the election. They allowed, during that period, early voting, they allowed registration to take place. They allowed, if you voted in a precinct that you had moved from recently. They allowed that vote to be counted for every candidate that wasn't precinct-specific. So it would be counted for the president, counted for a U.S. senator, and so on. And they made it easier for high school students and college students to register to vote and to be able to vote. So voting participation went up very dramatically. Particularly African-American voting participation went up very dramatically in North Carolina. In 1988, turnout in North Carolina was 48th in the nation out of 50 states. By 2004, it was 11th.
Oh, goodness.
So there was a 45% increase in turnout, and most of that was African-American. In North Carolina, we have voting statistics that the state compiles, which are by race. So we know actually how many people who voted were black. And we know that we know how many people voted early who were black, how many people voted early who were white, how many people registered the same day who were black and white, how many people voted out of precinct who were black and white. Mm-hmm. And in all of those cases, all of the changes that took place were disproportionately used by African Americans.
Hmm.
Then, in 2010, Republicans elected a majority of the legislature, and in 2012, they elected a governor. So, both houses of the legislature and the governor were controlled by the Republican Party. They basically repealed all the Democratic laws. They did so after the Shelby County decision. They had had a voter ID law, which was pending, and when on June 25th, 2013, when the Shelby County decision came down, they immediately changed that law and included their whole wish list of getting rid of all the Democratic laws that had made it easier to vote. And they passed it, and that's what's at issue in this lawsuit.
Interesting. All right, let's go to phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Lester in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Lester.
Hi. I appreciate all the historical information that your guest is providing, and I want to add something to it. Talking as a person who actually represented the League of Women Voters in the cases in the Wisconsin Supreme Court on voter ID.
Oh.
And I'm very familiar with the record in the federal court case in Milwaukee and the record in the state court case in Dane County about the impact of voter ID laws in Wisconsin. There is absolutely no question that the effect of voter ID is to limit the participation of the poorest people in the state. It makes it much more difficult for those people to vote. And it just so happens that the poorest people in the state, particularly in the Milwaukee area, are African American, Hispanic. But the underpinnings of the voter ID laws and the restrictions on early voting, but primarily the voter ID law, is the myth of voter impersonation fraud. That myth was perpetuated deliberately through think tanks, through editorials, through a conscious effort to create in the minds of white voters across the country the notion that there was widespread voter impersonation and widespread fraud. And even our current Senator Ron Johnson said at the time of the recall election that 30,000 people had been bussed into Wisconsin to vote and did so basically by voter impersonation. This is one of the biggest lies that has been perpetrated in this century, in fact, even in the last century. It is created out of whole cloth, and yet many people believe it. And I said repeatedly, and I'll say it again, and people who are listening should pay attention to this. The amount of voter impersonation fraud is lower than the number of people who have been abducted by aliens in this state. It just doesn't happen. But the bizarre thing is that the proponents of voter ID laws will say that the absence of evidence of voter impersonation is the evidence that voter impersonation goes on. And this is so preposterous, and yet it has been sold to a vast number of people who believe that it is true. And I think they believe it's true because they believe that poor people are likely to be fraudulent.
Well, what about the courts? When you argue this before the courts and you have facts, I mean, we're looking at facts here in many cases, Lester and Professor. Doesn't the court look at the facts in the case that there have not been hardly any cases of voter impersonation fraud?
Well, they do. In some places, in some cases. One of the things that's really quite extraordinary is there was a case from Indiana. And it went up to the Supreme Court, and Justice Stevens, of all people, who has since repudiated his decision in that case, tried to look at voter fraud, and he was forced, because of the lack of evidence, to go back to the Tammany era in the 19th century in New York to find evidence of voter fraud. And one of the things that's particularly insidious is that when they can't find any voter fraud, they say, well, if people think that there's voter fraud, it makes them feel better to pass such a law. And that is a sufficient basis for legislative action. As somebody who cares about facts about these things, as your caller does, that's absolutely infuriating to me. But there are a series of judicial decisions in which judges have said, that's all you need. If the legislators or the voters, no matter how ill-informed, are acting as if there were voter fraud, that's sufficient.
Lester, you want to respond?
Well, that's a correct recitation of what the courts have said. But I think one thing that has to be recognized is that there has been a studied effort to place people on the appeals courts in this country and on the Supreme Courts in the United States who adopt the political attitudes of the people who pay for the elections. And those people do not want poor people voting, because if poor people vote, there's a likelihood that they will vote against the interests of the wealthy people in the country. So the courts, to a certain extent, have been stacked with judges who are willing to suspend disbelief with regard to these issues. And frankly, the facts really do not matter because of precisely what the guest has said. If you believe it, that's enough, which is, for lawyers, it's a very, very bizarre concept, but there you have it. Facts don't matter. The legislature can make up anything it wants, and what's going to happen eventually is that there is going to be a tremendous backlash from poor people about this, because ultimately they're going to vote, and ultimately they're going to vote their own interests. But anybody who thinks that there isn't voter suppression in these laws is not paying attention.
Thank you, Lester, very much for the call. Well, it doesn't, if you believe that, in fairness, this doesn't portend very well for the future, Professor Kauser.
It doesn't. But there are cases, there are judges who put the case very well and who fill their opinions with so many facts, so well analyzed, that it's difficult for higher courts to overturn them on those sorts of bases. The judge in Texas who decided the voter ID case, her opinion is about 150 pages long, and it is just full of the facts that a lot of expert witnesses and lawyers have provided. It's relatively difficult to overturn these. But one of the things that's most interesting is that a conservative,
it's okay,
conservative Republican judge in Chicago had decided the Indiana voter ID case in the same way that the U.S. Supreme Court did, looked at evidence after having made that decision and changed his mind, and quite openly wrote about it and has gotten a lot of publicity for it and said, look, I didn't look at the evidence hard enough. I should have. I was wrong. There isn't any evidence of voter fraud. The voter ID law ought to be overturned. So even in the judges who were relatively conservative Republicans appointed by conservative Republican presidents sometimes change their mind when they see the facts. And that has happened to judges in a lot of cases on racial discrimination over the years. There's still hope for the judges.
Well, they ought to be looking at the evidence. Isn't that what they're supposed to do? Isn't that their job?
It is. Sometimes they feel that they're constrained by strange legal opinions. I mean, judges for a long time in school racial discrimination cases before Brown versus School Board felt constrained by Supreme Court decisions in Plessy versus Ferguson and other cases to say, well, we think actually the schools are not equal, but the Supreme Court has told us we should disregard that and say that segregated schools are equal, so we'll just do nothing. But that got overturned. And so there's always hope when all the evidence is in your favor.
Yeah. Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Lester, thank you so much for yours. If you're on hold, please stay with us for just a little while longer, and we'll be right with you. Our number, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the Supreme Court's decision 2 years ago in June, actually, striking down what you could call the heart of the Voting Rights Act. And our guest this hour, Professor Morgan Kauser, professor of history and social science at the California Institute of Technology, who's been studying voting rights and voting suppression in this country for some 35 years, has examined 4,190 some voting rights cases, Justice Department inquiries, settlements, and changes to laws. From 1957 to 2013, he found more than 90% of the legal events occurred in the jurisdictions that had been required to pre-clear their voting changes. The number of successful voting rights suits has gone down in recent years, he says, not because there's less discrimination, but because several Supreme Court decisions have made them harder to win. So that's the issue we're looking at this hour of the program, and welcoming you to our conversation. We'll continue in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Let's go to Steve in Cumberland next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks. I'm curious about Operation Crosscheck. My understanding is that it's a policy of various states to eliminate large numbers of people from the voter rolls if it appears as if they are registered in more than one state. The problem is that they don't check the authenticity of names, and if names appear the same, my understanding is thousands of people are being removed from voting rolls from both from across one state to another. Are you familiar with that? And are there any court cases?
There are some court cases, and that's been going on for some time now. And there were before Section 5 was before Section 5 was thrown out. There were objections to those procedures, and there are some court cases under Section 2 which have tried to overturn those. There is a great difficulty in matching names. Just think, Bob Jones, Robert Johnson, John Smith. You can find a great many people like that with the same birthdays in different states. So you really have to be extremely careful. And if you're not very careful, you can throw out people who are perfectly capable of voting. These sorts of checks have been used and failed in a great many places. Usually one of the things that happens is that so many people get irate because they show up at the polls and they are told that they can't vote. Some of them turn out to be Republicans. Some of them turn out to be people who have access to the media, etc. And very often what happens is that the voting registrars simply say, we just can't do this. This is just not working. It's not logical. It won't work. But there is the possibility, if the voting officials are more in favor of cutting down the vote, that it will have exactly the effect that the caller said. And there are going to be more cases, unquestionably, in 2016 brought to try to stop this. It's going to continue, but it probably has... There's a lot of litigation that will be brought to try to stop it.
Thanks, Steve. Margie in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling regards to your guest's comment that the judge or the courts can actually say, well, if there's a fear of voter fraud, that that's enough to make this ruling because it makes people feel more safe. Now, my question is, wouldn't you be able to counter that with saying the disenfranchised are afraid, have fear of discrimination here, and whose fear is more important? Especially when the people that have been disenfranchised, now that you have all of this proof over the years and with the states, whose fear is more important?
Well, unfortunately, I think that the fear of the legislators is more important, because the question is whether they had a discriminatory motive when they passed the law. The voters who are fearing being disenfranchised didn't pass the law. They opposed the law. So if the question is, did the legislators pass the law because of a racially discriminatory intent, or because they feared that there might be voter fraud, their motives are the ones that are in question. I agree with you on a moral basis, but on a legal basis, it's right to look at what the legislators did and what their motives were.
Thanks for the call. John in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. There was a website investigator, I think his name was Greg Paladin or something like that, who investigated the election of the primary election for president in 2000 in Florida. And he embarrassed a lot of people down there by asking them very difficult questions. I was wondering, do you know anything about the level of fraud, of disenfranchisement of people in Florida in that presidential primary there?
We have about a minute left, Professor.
I think it's Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T.
Right. Yeah.
And the best thing for you to do is to get that by looking at his website and looking for his reports. I do think that there was considerable disenfranchisement, particularly of people who were matched as out-of-state felons, the same sort of matching that an earlier caller discussed, but as felons. And the Secretary of State, who was also Bush's campaign manager in Florida, employed an outside company to match people, and they disproportionately matched African Americans. I think that was the biggest scandal of the election, and it's terrible that that Gore did not bring a case on those grounds. We might well have had a different president, no Iraq war, et cetera, et cetera.
Your work is never ending, isn't it?
That's right. As long as there is discrimination, there's always more work to do.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour has published the first comprehensive history of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. He's the author of Colorblind Injustice, Minority Voting Rights, and the Undoing of the Second Reconstruction. Came to our attention from I got the paper right here, April 19, editorial in the New York Times, Voting Rights by the Number, and was cited as the person in the country who's done an exhaustive study. His name is Professor J. Morgan Couser, K-O-U-S-S-E-R, if you want to look up all his research. He's a professor of history and social science at the California Institute of Technology and has examined almost 4,200 voting rights cases. And you can find his research if you Google his name. Thanks very much to KP Whaley for producing this hour, to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, and thanks for your calls and interest in this topic. We have news coming up from National Public Radio in just a moment, and then we're going to look at the city of Detroit. KP was there recently and thought it was just a very, very interesting place. The National Geographic has a story in this month's issue, Taking Back Detroit. We'll speak with the author and with a couple unlikely entrepreneurs who have invested quite a bit of money in the city.